Welcome to episode 11 of the R Squared podcast. I'm your host, Ian Levy. Today's guest is Seth Partnow, writer at Nylon Calculus. Also, can find Seth's work at the Washington Post's Fancy Stats blog, Clipper blog, B-Ball Breakdown, and about 15 other places. Today's episode, Seth and I talk about some of his recent articles at Nylon Calculus, his point guard personality test, some of the new sport view data that's been released, and the disconnect between what and how when it comes to analytics. Hey Seth, how's it going tonight?
Good, how you doing?
Good, glad to have you on again. This podcast has gotten pushed back a couple times, so some of the things we really wanted to have you on to talk about are things that, you know, now have been published, you know, a couple weeks ago. But one of the big ones that got a lot of attention on Nylon Calculus and a lot of people were really interested in really talking about was your point guard personality test. So for anybody who didn't read the post, I'm wondering if you can sort of lay out the basic framework there.
Sure. I mean, it's sort of the genesis of it was some of the comments which came out when the Kings decided to go with Darren Collison instead of Isaiah Thomas, kind of, you know, a pass first pure point guard, kind of this very language that's actually kind of silly when you dove into the numbers and saw that Darren Collison wasn't necessarily that much of a pass first player and stuff like that. So I wanted to really start to figure out if there was a way to put some degree of rigor in kind of this nomenclature of point guards, whether it's pass first or, you know, a slasher or you know, a scoring point guard or something like that. And so that was sort of the genesis of the idea, is to describe the style of play of various point guards without reference to kind of their effectiveness in that style.
And so we had all these descriptive statistics. You had all of these descriptive things available, but they had never sort of been merged into something sort of comprehensively descriptive.
Sure. Well, I wouldn't say we've always had them. I mean, a lot of it is very kind of based on kind of the less sort of evaluatively useful sport view stuff is kind of like, you know, touches and time of possession and stuff like that, which is very much just telling you about, you know, style rather than achievement. And so kind of rolling those up in certain ways kind of allowed for a description of how somebody's playing, not just, you know, they've scored this many points or taken this many shots, but, so point guard X has the ball almost, you know, twice as much in over the course of a game as this other guy. I mean, whether, you know, you pick an example, whether it's kind of, you know, a Chris Paul, very, you know, at least the perception always on the ball versus, you know, especially last year in Dallas, say a Jose Calderon, who was sort of sharing point guard duties and in many ways was almost the two guard on offense to Monte Ellis.
Yeah, yeah. And so you, the end result was not necessarily sort of a single label of somebody as pass first or shoot first or off ball or whatever, but you were looking at point guards on four different spectrum. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. It's kind of a little bit tongue in cheek called it the personality test because it was loosely based on kind of the Myers-Briggs personality, which is, you know, on some level actually fairly useful to determine, oh yeah, that is why I don't get along with certain kinds of people. But so it was loosely based on that, kind of describing sort of four in you know, the formal Myers-Briggs, it's the dichotomies of a personality, and I kind of worked with that, kind of the pass first and shoot first and on ball off ball, driving versus, and I call it probing, and that's not the best name for the kind of the opposite of driving, but it's someone who, you know, basically trying to get to the rim versus kind of staying more mid-range around the arc.
Okay.
Point guard with the ball. And then the last one is just is floor spacing, because that seems like it's a kind of a big difference, not a big differentiator, but kind of between the point guards who can and or do and don't like to shoot threes.
Mm-hmm. And so who were some of the players who sort of stood out maybe as examples of different spots along those spectrum?
Obviously,
I was just going to say, you mentioned Calderon as sort of an off-ball floor spacer, kind of a prober.
Didn't necessarily have the ball in his hands that much. Passed slightly more than he shot. A lot of threes, not so many drives. Versus a guy like maybe Jeremy Lin, who also, you know, playing with James Harden, didn't have the ball that as much as some point guards, but much more kind of get to the rim, much more shoot first and get to the rim kind of a player. And then, you know, obviously there's a guy like Steph Curry who it's almost single-handedly changed the metric I had to use for floor spacing. I was going to use just catch and shoot threes, and he shot so many threes off the dribble as opposed to catch and shoot that he would have shown up as not, you know, a prime floor spacer. And if that's the case, then the metric is broken.
Yeah, that guy's an alien, a scale buster. So I know you said part of the impetus was this Isaiah Thomas, Darren Collison comparison and the change that the Kings made. So once you had this personality test established, what did it look like for the comparison between Collison and Thomas?
Well, I mean, first of all, Darren Collison wasn't that much more of a pass first point guard last mm-hmm. year in LA as Thomas was in Sacramento. Yeah. And it's not as if that was, you know, because Collison was sharing a lot of time with Chris Paul. I mean, he played, I don't have it in front of me, but he played somewhere around 30% of his minutes last year with Chris Paul. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just that he was, you know, kind of sort of playing two guard or something like that. He basically just did less while he was on the floor, and that led me to believe that the Kings' offense this year would be kind of DeMarcus Cousins already led the NBA in usage last year, so he didn't really have much room to go up offensively in terms of, you know, having the ball. So that indicated to me more Rudy Gay, and mm-hmm. historically Rudy Gay at kind of a 25 usage has been a pretty good player. At a 30 usage has been a mess, so that kind of worried me. Big part of the Kings start this year is Rudy Gay has been great, so I was kind of I'm going to claim a partial victory on this, and I think I described what their offense was going to do reasonably well. It's just Rudy Gay has played better than he maybe did in a similar role in Toronto.
Yeah,
he has in Sacramento now.
So not bad. It was a descriptive, you were after a descriptive metric, and
right.
you know, it ended up describing the situation well. So I know with something like this, and we got a lot of questions in the comments on Nylon Calculus, and it seemed like a lot of the response on Twitter was automatically sort of like, how do you take this to a productive or evaluative standpoint? So having a metric like this in your back pocket, understanding sort of how point guards fit stylistically, is there a place to use that to sort of inform, you know, what good offensive units look like, what good roster construction looks like, things like that?
That's certainly kind of next steps. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason I started with point guards is we have a lot of kind of in the public sphere, a lot of kind of data that describes reasonably well the things that a point guard does in term on offense. Mm-hmm. And while conceptually you can sort of start to think of some other stuff, I'm not sure the data is as there yet for some of those other things. It's definitely something I'm interested in, especially kind of on the lineup level, to sort of describe kind of the various items you need, whether it's rim protection and passing ability and shooting ability and so on and so forth on both ends of the court, and to what extent those skills are duplicative between players, or having more is better. Conceptually, you know, if you have one rim protector that's on the floor, that's probably close to good. Two might be a little better. Three, kind of almost who cares because it's the geometry of the floor. But on the other hand, like you can never have too much shooting on the floor.
Yeah,
you can maybe have too many guys who want to shoot, but that's a different thing than having. I mean, if you have like all the things being equal, having all five guys being able to hit three pointers would be good for an offense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I'm definitely interested in looking at. Haven't dove too deeply into it. And partially that's just because conceptually it's going to take a fair amount of thought and a look at the data that's out there to see if there's, you know, kind of reasonable proxies for some of these things.
Do you feel like this point guard personality test, do you feel like this fits into sort of a larger framework of the positional revolution, which I know seems like people are sort of not talking about it as much or not paying attention to it as much, but I know like the first year I went to Sloan 3 years ago, I think there was two different papers or two different presentations with people using cluster analysis to define positions in different ways and sort of it seemed like what the end result was these groupings of players that were defined by stylistic tendencies instead of height or any of the other normal ways that sort of positions are defined. So do you feel like it sort of fits into that framework?
Yeah, I think that the positional revolution as it is a recognition that, you know, at least the way I like to think about it is we're talking about, you know, roles and skill sets rather than, you know, the second tallest guy on the floor does this.
Yeah.
The third tallest guy on the floor does this kind of thing. At the same time, I think that between this and kind of the true usage stuff, which we talked about last time, I think I'm kind of sort of coming back around to the idea that what's thought of as quote unquote point guard play is something that's maybe been undervalued, not necessarily undervalued, just under cataloged, that this thing exists with kind of an offense initiation and creation guy on the floor. And, you know, the teams that get away with having, you know, point guards who don't do that are teams that have, you know, your James Hardens and your LeBron James and wing players who kind of do traditional quote unquote point guard stuff. And it, you know, why the players who tend to have those skills, tend to be the 6'3" guy. That's probably as a result of partially of, you know, just population, there being more of them to choose from. And also, you know, it's something that's taught and learned as well. So if, as long as, you know, those guys are the ones quote playing point guard, those are the ones who are going to get to the NBA and have point guard skills.
Mm-hmm.
So will Giannis Antetokounmpo ever be a point guard? Probably not, because he wasn't, you know, trying to be one until he was, you know, 18 or 19 years old, and that might be a little late.
I only ask about this positional revolution thing because I have this sort of theory which has sort of a hypothetical research project behind it, which I've never actually tackled. But but my idea is that, like, so when I was looking at these clusters, so clusters and thinking about your point guard test too. So really, what we're defining players by are their skills and their stylistic tendencies on the floor. And once you get to that point, it's like, what does it matter? I don't want to say it. Like, what's the value of finding similar players to cluster them with and then assign a name to what they do on the floor? So like, if you're looking at you know, so theoretically, if there was a similar test to what you developed for sort of the whole range of players, of not just point guards, but sort of everybody on the floor, and it would be extremely complicated. But if you potentially had that in place, when you were building a lineup from that thing, you wouldn't necessarily be like, I want to pick a player from this cluster and a player from this cluster and a player from this cluster who complement each other. You would just be looking for players who complement each other by the skills. Right. And so I sort of have this thought of like, why even talk about positions? Let's just talk about the skills. Let's just talk about how the skills fit together and sort of, I don't know, the idea of going back to positions seems like something of a wasted step.
That's an interesting thought. It's possible that this kind of cluster analysis will reveal that that for whatever reason that players do kind of almost self-sort themselves into these boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you want a rim protector, well, that guy's gonna be a big man.
Yeah,
because those are the guys who have those skills and so on and so forth. So could we talk about just skills? Maybe, but at the same time, and this is something that is always crops up specifically in kind of the Kevin Love discussion, mm-hmm. is like he does all these non-big man things for a big man, and that's cool. But the quote big man things, one of them, rim protection, he does very badly. So all mm-hmm. of a sudden, one of your spots on the floor that's supposed to have this skill
mm-hmm.
Doesn't have it, and you need to find it somewhere else.
Because he can't defend another place, so it's not like you can just make him be a small forward or a shooting guard,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I see that. I just like thinking about in this sort of hypothetical fantasy world that I've imagined. The idea is like, all right, we want to build a lineup. We want to make sure we have four guys who are solid screeners, and we want to make sure we have four guys who are outside shooters, and we want to make sure we have three guys who can create off the dribble, and maybe one and a half guys who can defend the rim. And, one guy who can generate a lot of turnovers on the wing. And then once you sort of have the idea of how much overlap you want between those skills, then it doesn't matter if it's, if it's a guy like LeBron who literally has all of those skills, whether you've got, three Nick Batums or one LeBron and a bunch of other, and then some Shane Battiers or something like that.
Well, first of all, a team with three Nick Batums would be my favorite team ever in the history of the world.
Yeah.
So, no, that's a fair point. I that's certainly down the road. Maybe mm-hmm. that's something that's plausible. At the same time, like I said, I think that we're at the point still where just kind of by virtue of it's not no intrinsic reason it has to be other than. Players have been sorted into these positions for their entire basketball lives. And so they, with some outliers, that the skill sets have been developed within kind of these silos. So yes, you don't need to stick in those silos, but if that's the players that exist, then you need to stick in those silos to get the things that you need to have a successful lineup.
Fair enough. It's a wild hair for sure, and I've never tackled it because I'm not sure it totally makes sense. But
no, it's definitely I've kind of been thinking of a similar thing, and what we're in terms of like I said earlier, like how many shooters is there like an inflection point where two is not enough, three is enough, four is better, but
diminishing returns or whatever. Yeah.
The big difference is between two and three or something like that. And that's stuff like that is very interesting. And I think does have, a great deal of implication for team construction. And also, it if depending on what that number is, a guy who is a point guard who can't shoot could either, it certainly won't increase their value, but if you need four shooters on the floor, a point guard who can't shoot suddenly becomes much less valuable.
Yeah.
Whereas a power forward who can becomes even more so.
Yeah, and we sort of see that already. If a player has a limited skill set, it sort of, it handcuffs the roster construction because you have to have, maybe fit certain other more unique, less available players around them. Well, so the point guard test was fantastic. Hopefully, not to put too too obvious a nudge there, but hopefully there's some more coming with that, because that was really great. We'd love to see some more work with it. One of the other things that you've been writing about early this season also that we wanted to talk about was some of the new SportView stuff, some of the new stuff that had been released, and some I know you were recording this Thursday evening, and you just before we sat down to record, you released your first batch of rim protection numbers, which is a permutation that you started last year with the SportView stuff that was available last year, and so this is your first run with the numbers this year. So what's in the new SportView stuff out this year, what's got you excited? What's been fun to play around with?
I feel like I haven't really even, I've spent most of my time with kind of the shot data. Mm-hmm. I haven't really gotten into, you know, the rebounding and passing and defense stuff as much. The rim protection is based, you know, wholly on stuff that was available last year as well.
Yeah.
But the detail we now have about, you know, every shot taken, and the data isn't perfect. There's, you know, errors here and there. We've kind of, at Nylon Calculus, kind of through trial and error, we're kind of sort of stumbling our way through just how kind of messy the play-by-play is. and by the way, understandably so, I think. I mean, if you're doing the play-by-play of a game and, you know, there's a shot that gets blocked and rebounded and a fast break happens, something like that, that's like six events you have to record in 4 seconds. And IDing the player and descriptors and all that kind of stuff.
We had John Schumann on a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about he has a system for hand charting stuff during games. He doesn't do it for every game, but he said important playoff games and stuff like that. And I asked him, you know, what has he learned from this hand charting thing? And he said, I've really learned to appreciate media timeouts because any extra break for me to catch up on the hand charting, you know, because he was saying he's always sort of like a possession behind.
Yeah, no, and so, but the. Regardless of kind of some of the, you know, I think we kind of estimated that we were pretty confident in, you know, about $180,000 of the 200,000 shots that were taken last year, mm-hmm. having the full data for them. So that's, you know, that's not bad. But, and just the amount of data that we have access to in terms of where on the court, how close a defender was, how much time was left in the quarter and on the shot clock, and mm-hmm. whether it was off the dribble or and all these kind of things. This is, you know, just the detail of this data is pretty amazing, and I think we're just barely scratching the surface of what it can tell us, because this is, you know, really everything that, I don't even want to say everything, but so much more of what we wanted to know about what goes into a shot, you know, in terms of, okay, mid-range shots are bad, but is there a difference between, you know, say a Brandon Bass, who's a great catch and shoot mid-range jump shooter, how much different of a shot is that for him if he's, you know, catching it and shooting with nobody near him versus, you know, having to put the ball on the floor once and pulling up with a guy in his face? How much of a difference does that make? I mean, intuitively, you know, one's a harder shot than the other, but we've never until now really had the means. And I don't want to say to test it, because when we start getting down to that level, it's few enough attempts that there's a certain amount of just randomness, whether the ball went in or not on some of them. But still, we can start to over, you know, a number of players and a large enough sample size, we can start to understand just a little bit better that it's not just mid-range shots that are bad. It's kind of the contested mid-range shot off the dribble is really not very good.
And one of the other things that you pulled out that in retrospect was sort of just sitting there waiting for the data to confirm it was that corner threes have less to do with the value of corner threes maybe has less to do with distance and more to do with the geometry of the court, and that they're harder to defend.
Yeah, I think so. My initial post kind of posited that it was because they were more open, and I got some feedback on it, and I think it's correct that it's a combination of being more open and being more catch and shoot, which and that's hard to untangle because pull-up shots in general are closer defended. I ran the numbers a couple weeks ago, and I think it's about like a foot and a half difference between, you know, how close the closest defender is on a pull up shot and a catch and shoot shot. So, for the purposes of being quote open, it doesn't necessarily matter whether it's one or the other, because both of those things mean that the defense is doing less to bother the shot, not that it's the 18 inches or so that it's that 18-21 inches closer to the basket you are. It's the it's the fact that you're more open, because I mean it's in the corner, so where's the next guy going to rotate from? It's kind of my spin on it.
And it's funny because, you know, like I said, this was something that was sort of just sitting there. You know, we've had shot location data for a while, and we've had shot distance data for a while, and the difference between the difference in field goal percentage between a corner three-pointer and a two-pointer of the same distance, you know, from elsewhere on the court is negligible. And so the sort of argument that the corner three-pointer was all about it being a foot closer didn't really hold water, but nobody really paid attention to it until there was something else to look at.
And actually, interestingly, after I wrote that piece, someone pointed me to a Ken Pomeroy article where he found a similar effect in college where the line is uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Corner threes are slightly higher percentage in college as well. So without, you know, the detailed, you know, defense location data and stuff like that, it's hard to say exactly, you know, that's the same thing, but that's certainly a supporting piece of information, because the geometry is similar, even if the court distance isn't.
So when you're working on a piece like that, did you have in mind that you were going to explore that when you sat down to start playing with the numbers, or were you just fiddling with the numbers and that sort of popped out at you?
I think I was watching a game and somebody, like my pet peeve is teams rotating up off of, you know, I think we've seen it a ton of times where like a big man gets the ball at kind of 18 feet on the wing and a defender comes flying off a shooter in the corner to contest it. And he, you know, kicks the ball to the wide open shooter in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching a Hawks game and someone rotated off Kyle Korver like that. And I was just like, what is Kyle? If you leave Kyle Korver open in the corner, what is he going to shoot?
Yeah.
And so I was kind of, and then I was kind of exploring that. And then I wanted to see kind of who were the kind of some of the best corner 3-point shooters when they're wide open. And I was looking at it and I realized that the numbers of wide open corner threes were much closer to the total number of corner threes attempted than I would have expected, and that it seemed like I must have something wrong here. So I started to look into it, and then I realized that you know the defense tends to be farther away from you know corner 3-point shooters than above the break 3-point shooters.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I love that process because I feel like that happens to me, and often that's where some of my best stuff happens. Is yeah, you see something in a game, you're like that seems weird, or I'm not sure why that happens or how, and you start digging into the numbers, which something pops up, which then leads you to cast a slightly wider net and a slightly wider net, and then all of a sudden you sort of stumble into something that you're like, oh, well, this explains, you know, a big chunk of what I was wondering about.
Yeah, and it was very much, I kind of had a Bill and Ted moment. I was like, whoa. I can only imagine what thin percentage of the listeners are actually going to know what we're talking about. When Bill and Ted were two funny movies, watch them.
They were, yeah, a big part of my childhood, I can tell you that for sure. So how about your rim protection numbers that you put up tonight? Maybe you can just quickly give people just sort of the methodology, what it's based on, and then, you know, who's standing out so far this season.
Basically, it's something I started messing around with the SportView data last year.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with a lot of metrics for things other than scoring is trying to translate how that relates to this the value on the scoreboard. And we've kind of seen some attempts at doing that, and it leads to results that are occasionally counterintuitive, like a steal No, this is not actually what the Ben Moore's piece did not actually say. A steal is worth 9 points.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the gloss that was put on it in sort of through a game of telephone and stuff. But yeah. it's a counterintuitive results. However, with this new data, kind of talking about, you know, not just like a binary, like a shot block is a yes or a no, but what percentage does a player allow on shots at the rim? And then you can sort of compare that to what both what the percentage would be if there was no one defending the rim, and then also what the percentage would be against kind of average defense. And so from there you can guesstimate, estimate really kind of the points that this guy's rim defense is saving a team. And so that's kind of the basics of the metric. And unsurprisingly, guys like, you know, Roy Hibbert, Andrew Bogut, Omer Asik, Dwight Howard, all very good on this. Some guys who are good shot blockers, but not necessarily great overall defenders. Andre Drummond in the past, JaVale McGee, stuff like that, don't show up as well because, you know, yes, they block a shot, but there's also the three times a game where, you know, they overcommit to a guard driving and it's an easy dump off pass and a layup or a dunk or something like that.
So I know one of the things that came out of it last year was that Anthony Davis did not look great despite the fact that he was leading the league in blocks. And I just pulled up the numbers and he's actually in the negative. Am I reading that right?
You're reading that correctly this year. Davis, especially when paired with Asik this year, it's a bit different than it was last year. One thing I found is it's very kind of team and context dependent.
Okay.
Generally speaking, a team with one good rim protector has one good rim protector if they share the floor a lot.
Yeah.
And that to some extent makes some sense. In the Pacers last year, David West was chasing people on all over the floor and Roy Hibbert was defending the rim. David, I think, eye test wise, at least earlier in his career, who knows now, David West was a reasonably good, if not better than, you know, interior defender, but when he's paired with Roy Hibbert, he's spending less time near the basket.
Gotcha. So it looks like Davis's contest percentage is really low. And you're saying that's because, the scheme allows for Ajik to contest a lot more of those shots when they're on the floor.
Yeah.
Together.
And though his contest percentage was very low last year as well, it at least makes sense this year because last year, Davis is chasing a guard 25 feet from the basket and, you know, Jason Smith or Ryan Anderson is the other big man under the rim. That's less ideal. Whereas if you have Omer Asik, then that's probably a good division of labor and let, you know, Davis's, you know, length and athleticism create some havoc around the perimeter.
And get
those crazy shot blocks from out of nowhere, which it's demoralizing. But if you think about it, you know, blocking a mid-range shot is cool, but it's not as valuable as blocking a shot at the rim because it was a shot that was going to go in less anyway.
Theoretically, with lineup data, would it work? I guess it wouldn't work because we don't have all the sport view stuff on lineups. But theoretically, I was thinking looking at rim protection as tandems. But that data is not there. The other one I wanted to ask you, this just popped out at me. So by your numbers, rim points saved per 36. So Chris Kaman is fifth, right between Gasol and Sam D'Alembert. Just seems crazy to me because I think of Kaman as just like an absolute disaster defensively. But I was writing a thing for Bleacher Report before the season started about how the Lakers, you know, could be an epically awful defense this year. And I was looking at defensive real plus minus for players who had been on the Lakers roster last year and then this year. And Kaman, by defensive real plus minus, Kaman was really good defensively last year for the Lakers. So what am I missing?
He showed up really well in the rim protection last year, and I actually that was a result that surprised me last year as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and looked at some kind of, you know, single year XRAPM Ds and all these, you know, alphabet soups of various metrics that people have put out over the years, and you know, he wasn't necessarily ever or always elite, but he showed up as surprisingly good, or at least surprisingly non-terrible most years. And this is, you know, rim protection is a slice of defense. And if I had to guesstimate it, I'd say it's probably 40% of a big man's defensive value. And that's sort of semi-informed. I think, last year, Kevin Hetrick did some kind of, he regressed kind of, the rim protection stuff on kind of, a similar kind of RAPM, and found that it explained about 40% of the variation.
Mm-hmm.
So, so that was kind of, you know, between that and, you know, pick and roll defense and rebounding, I feel like it's a third or 40% or something like that of a big man's defenses. So you can be, you know, a guy like Ryan Hollins, mm-hmm. great rim protector, terrible at everything else to the point where he's still a largely negative player. So, and, you know, there are guys who are good defenders who are, you know, mediocre-ish rim defenders because they do other things well.
Mm-hmm.
I think Joakim Noah, at least last year, was, you know, not non-elite, if I remember correctly, in rim defense. But obviously everything else he did was pretty awesome, even though I still think Hibbert should have won Defensive Player of the Year last year. But
yeah, I was in that camp too, but I guess I need to spend some more time watching Chris Kamen, I guess. So how about DeMarcus Cousins? His numbers look really strong, and how big an improvement are his numbers this year over where he was last year?
He was, you know, for a guy with his defensive rep, he was, at least on that metric, better than expected last year. Mm-hmm. And having talked to some other folks who, like, his ability to create turnovers as a center also meant he had, you know, not insignificant defensive value. And you know, this year Sacramento is their strong start is based, you know, on A, shooting a ton of free throws, and B, on playing really good defense. And mm-hmm. and Cousins is really, you know, he's anchoring that. And it shows up in the rim protection and his rebounding and other places as well. So, I mean, he is showing up better there this year than last year. Now, whether that's something that's sustainable, you know, we're 10% of the way through the season, so we'll see.
Was there anybody else on there who sort of popped out at you or surprised you with their results?
Rudy Gobert is contesting 73% of opposing shots at the rim while he's on the floor.
To be fair, with his wingspan, he could stand at the 3-point line and still contest shots at the rim.
and the thing about that is that this is, you know, a measure of
yeah, it's body position.
Is not necessarily as well understood as it maybe could be. Is that SportView is measuring body position. So, you know, talking about a shot where the defender is 2 feet away, that's, you know, that's kind of extend your arm and halfway down your forearm. That's mm-hmm. how far the defender's chest is from you. And you would in a pickup basketball game, that's a guy being all over you, and your teammates would yell at you if you shot. So the distance is not as big as those numbers would indicate. In terms of the closest defender,
yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are pretty incredible numbers for him, and Favors looks like he's in the positive too, so that's a good sign for them. I'm looking for Enes Kanter down at the there he is down at the bottom.
Yeah, down at the bottom with Spencer Hawes and Kevin Love and
Spencer Hawes looks bad.
Yeah, and Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan's had a bad start to the year defensively as well, and I think that, you know, just watching the Clippers, we can see that. But he's also a guy who improved, kind of running this kind of analysis several times over last year. He started really poorly last year, and then kind of from about Thanksgiving on was actually quite good.
Jordan was.
So DeAndre, yes.
Yeah, and I noticed Luis Scola, bless his heart, opponents are shooting 73.3% on shots at the rim defended by Luis Scola.
That's he's almost there's kind of that won't take too much for them to actually be shooting better with him defending than with nobody there at all.
It's like he's giving them a boost. Here, step up a hill.
Yeah. last year, uncontested shots at, in that distance were like at 79%.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's been a rough start. All right, let's change gears here before I find any other Pacers on here. So one of the other things,
Mahinmi has been worse this year. Also, sorry.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't been good to watch either. I mean, he's been not great.
Yeah, even Hibbert has fallen off a fair amount, but he was so much better than everybody else last year that he's still kind of I want to say second to Gobert in a per minute basis so far this year.
Yeah,
and the other guy, actually, since we're talking about it, who's fallen off and probably unsurprisingly has been Serge Ibaka. Was great rim protector last year, but with all the mess in OKC in terms of injuries and stuff like that. He's not been nearly as good in that area.
You think just the scheme's falling apart?
Yeah, and I think also he's probably having to expend more energy on offense also, which, you know, it's that's a real thing.
Yeah.
You know, James Harden might be a punchline, but, you know, there's the list of guys who can play all out at both ends of the court, carrying a heavy offensive load for, you know, 30-plus minutes a game.
Uh-huh.
In terms of players that are healthy right now, was I think zero. you know, no, as of, you know, 2 years ago, LeBron could do it, and Wade could probably do it. This LeBron and this Wade probably can't do it for you know maximal intensity on both ends for. So at least that's my thought, at least.
And it's a bummer for OKC because both Steven Adams and Nick Collison look terrible too. They're, you know, in the bottom 20, 30 guys there. So the other thing that I wanted to make sure we had enough time to talk with, because I thought this was really interesting, was you wrote a piece, I guess it was earlier this week, days are blending together, but we sort of characterized it when we were publishing it as the disconnect between the what and the how, that analytics sometimes can offer a lot of information about the what and then sort of maybe runs out of steam when we get to the how. So I wonder if you can just sort of give people the setup where that idea came from.
Basically there was last weekend, I think there was a game where Milwaukee was, it's a situation that happens tons of times, you know, you're inbounding the ball, 10 seconds left, down two, do you go for the tie or do you go for the win? The math is almost, you know, it's not particularly close that going for the win is better, you know, in terms of win expectation.
Yeah.
Okay. That's, so the problem is that that a good defensive team knows this also. I mean, if you've ever played a pickup game by ones and twos and you're up 14-13 game to 15 and you're checking the ball up, what is the one thing everybody yells? No twos.
Yeah.
So I mean, if Joe Pickup can figure that out, then I think that that NBA players and coaches have probably kind of grokked to that a little bit too.
So it's sort of a cycle, right? Like so if you're playing the percentages, the defense also knows what the percentages are and knows that you'll probably play the percentages, which then changes the percentages.
Yes, and also it's okay. The defense wants to keep you from shooting a three, so you still would like to shoot a three. Now, how do you do it?
Yeah,
and at that point, you know, pure analytics is kind of silence, because it's where we've kind of exited the realm of math and entered the realm of kind of strategy and tactics. And you failed because you didn't do the best possible thing. And that kind of ignores the fact that, you know, the other team has a say in it also. I mean, if you were just, you know, five guys on the court and run a play and shoot a shot, and you don't shoot a three, obviously you've done something terrible. But, you know, with the defense out there, as Charles Barkley likes to say, is them guys getting paid too.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of figuring out, all right, this is where my, as kind of an analytics person, or at least the analytics part of my skills ends here. All right, now it has to be kind of a more basketball specific strategy. How do I get this three?
Mm-hmm. So one of the thoughts that I had when I read that piece was like, okay, so we talk about the idea of constantly that like the barrier for analytics or whatever is communication, just sort of like adequately communicating their findings and in a way that sticks. So when I was reading your piece, I was thinking, okay, so the next step of communication for analytics is, you know, take Brandon Knight, who's the point guard, that situation you talked about is getting him to understand the percentages of this sort of like cascading scenario, these cascading set of scenarios where if he does this and the defense reacts this way, then in that situation this is the high percentage play, and then in the next situation this is the high percentage play. And so as I was thinking that through, I was like, oh, you know, we've had players who've been able to do that for years, just sort of intuitively without maybe an analytics background, and we just called it high basketball IQ, you know, that when we talk about smart players or heady players or players with a high basketball IQ, really what we're talking about is players who understand those percentages and sort of adjust on the fly.
Right. I mean, it's more, okay, if you tell them this is good, this is what we want to do, and then it's kind of, it's not, I don't think it's terribly dissimilar to, you know, a quarterback in football kind of doing a progression of reads or whatever. It's like, all right, the defense did this, so that's open. And certainly at watching point guards as much as I have been for the stuff I've been, you can kind of see a difference in kind of the I don't know if it's the point guard gene or anything quite so, stereotypical, but, you know, and just in terms of that degree of anticipation where, all right, I saw that guy take a step the wrong direction. I know what's open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it can't be in the moment. It can't be a situation where Brandon Knight, who by all accounts if I remember correctly, he graduated high school in like 3 years.
Yeah.
It's a smart guy, but on the floor, that's not something, okay, well, covered this percentage is blah, blah, blah. It's like, it has to be automatic and ingrained. And so it's not a thought thing. It's like, all right, covered, go to the basket. If someone helps, I kick to the corner. We get a shot for the win. If they don't, I shoot a layup.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be all kind of drilled and non-verbalized. Otherwise he hesitates and can't do any of it. And you get a terrible shot and lose.
And it's funny because, so I know like Nate Silver's book, The Signal and the Noise, and some of the early stuff they did at 538, Nate Silver, it seemed like he was advocating for Bayesian statistics, you know, the idea of Bayesian priors, and you sort of start with a prior expectation and you adjust with new input and you are always sort of dealing in probabilities. And that you know, what we think of as smart players are players who sort of think in that mindset that they, yeah, like you were saying, the coach wants this. This is the optimal outcome here, but defense has adjusted, so that changes the probabilities. And it's funny because the way Silver has sort of sometimes framed that conversation is that people are dealing with pure analytics, and he wants to come back to these probabilities, and it's like that's sort of like that's where the X's and O's, the good X's and O's sort of basketball stuff has already been existing and sort of already been operating.
Right. And I think that and this is something I'm working on now for another site, sorry, Ian. the research and background analytics can sort of inform that decision. In terms of, all right, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, rotating off the corner shooter, so the next guy has to be kind of the big man from under the basket. Well, if you know that you have to get within, you know, 3 feet to even sort of bother, Then maybe think, ooh, that scheme, not so much, because I'm asking, you know, the, I'm asking my center to, you know, cover 10 feet of ground in a time frame that I really can't ask him to do that. So that's that, you know, in that way, knowing kind of a little bit more about the probabilities instead of just intuiting, well, I guess intuiting, well, running at a shooter is good, therefore run at all shooters.
Mm-hmm.
is maybe you're not going to ask the player in the moment to make that decision, but you're going to drill it in such a way that you put them in a position to have kind of easier reads to make almost.
So I don't really, totally makes sense. But I don't know the answer to this because I never really played organized basketball at any at any sort of real level. But so do you feel like there is a finite? Do you feel like there's sort of a finite level of detail to what you can drill ahead of time? You know, so you know, obviously we can drill run at shooters, and then, you know, you could add the layer of, you know, run at shooters, but not if there's this shooter, and then you add, well, run at shooters, but not in this way or at this time, you know, sort of like how fine do you feel like that can be drilled, ahead of time?
I mean, that's a good question. And it's the kind of thing that also, like, when you're fresh, like, it's those decisions are easier. And when you fatigue, like, some of you start to make kind of wrong decisions. I mean, looking back on kind of the drills in my own playing career, such as it was, is, you know, all right, you recognize that this kind of action is going to happen. You do this, that, and this to you know, defend all the things that are coming. I mean, if you know, you know that your guy is setting a cross screen and then you're going to get down screen. Well, you bump the cutter and then you get on your man's hip and you close out and you stay ball side and blah, 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 and all these things. And that's, you know, that's a lot of information to process in a short amount of time, but you've drilled that specific scenario so much that it's automatic.
Mm-hmm.
Now adding simple stuff like, all right, this guy's left-handed, so I close out a little bit different. All right, that's simple enough. All right, this guy I can't shoot, so I don't close out as hard. Okay, that's a little bit more. And then at a certain point, yes, it is too much information. And, you know, especially kind of in the day-to-day grind of the NBA, you're kind of, you know, setting up stuff so it's the best case versus everybody, rather than, you know, this is specifically how we're going to deal with Kyle Korver or something like that. Cause we play Kyle Korver twice or four times all season. And so, and we have very limited practice time. So putting in something, this is how we play Kyle Korver, is, you know, talk about diminishing returns in terms of coaching detail and practice time.
Yeah. So we were talking sort of before we started recording, but so all this new sport view data, this new sort of granular level of data with dribbles and defender distance and all sorts of added layers of detail, to all these statistics. Do you feel like there's something of diminishing returns there? If there's only so much that you can sort of work into the intuition of a player or of a unit, is some of this level of detail need to be sort of generalized or glossed over when it becomes sort of put into practice or put into a team's offensive or defensive scheme?
I think that the kind of the glossing over and the generalization happens at that step. I think when you're, you know, you kind of have to design the scheme, you have sort of, I don't want to say unlimited time, but I mean, if you're, you know, Thibs, you're up till 3 a.m. anyway. So so then, I mean, the decision-making process is, all right, this guy needs to get here by this time. You know, theoretically from this fine-grained data, we'll be able to say that if the defender gets to this spot on the floor in this amount of time, then that's worth, you know, a 10% degradation in the shot that's coming, or just as an example. So then as he's, you know, kind of designing playing his defense, he can say, all right, we would like that outcome. Should the opposition shooting 10% worse is great. Is this possible to ask in terms of, you know, everything else that's going on? And it's not just sprinting out on that shooter. It's also, you have to think about rebounding and what happens if they fake a pass and do something else. And so it's the system is very complex. But having kind of some actual numbers to inform kind of those endpoints allows you to make, I think, better kind of estimations. And then from there, you kind of shrug your shoulders and pays your money and takes your chances to a certain degree. And, you know, you always, at that point, you know, you always want your team to execute better, but, you know, you kind of have to, at a certain point, say, all right, the scheme is what it is. Let's do as good as we can in that scheme.
Yeah. It's funny to me. I find this topic so interesting because just thinking about the basketball that I grew up watching, which existed in a totally different sort of era and space from the, you know, the stuff we watch today, which is so informed and so driven by analytics. Not that they just, you know, rolled the ball out there and played basketball in the mid-90s, but, you know, I think about how... If think about guys who were able to close like an athletic gap by the ability to sort of weigh these probabilities intuitively before anybody was tracking them or teaching them, or I guess maybe not before people were paying attention to them, that maybe that's not fair, but before people sort of had data to validate it. You know, I think about the Pacers and I think about, a guy like Mark Jackson, and everything that he did was about manipulating angles and pulling defenders and things like that. And that so much of his skill set was really a mental weighing of probabilities.
And I think it's always, I mean, that's the kind of at the base, you know, even if you're not thinking about it in those terms, that's the base of any kind of, you know, athletics. And, you know, all to my mind, all the analytics are doing is a better, a more exact job of saying what's good, what you should you be, try to be doing. You know, I think that teams did... In terms of what they were trying to do, I think they probably did them about as well then as they do now. It's just that, you know, people know more about, you know, that, you know, I think last time we talked about, you know, Isaiah Thomas not shooting threes. I think if Isaiah Thomas is the first one, not the Suns guard. Big Zeke, not little Zeke. you know, I think that if he was in an environment where the importance of the three-pointer is what it is now, I think that he works on his three-point shot more and becomes a better three-point shooter, because it's something that's important in the context of the game he's playing. So, you know, the kind of stuff like, you know, teams were post-up play was dominant, so teams got pretty good at you know, figuring out how to double team the post and make other people beat them and stuff like that. Well, now in today's rule set, the post play is de-emphasized, both kind of because of the skill set of the players and the rule set in place. So it's not as go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, something that I think you were sort of hinting at before we started recording, but you were saying that that sometimes maybe the revolutionized or the revolution that's attributed to analytics is maybe overblown, and that you know, it's going back to it's changed the hows, but maybe not the whats or the how wells.
I would put it the other way. I think it has changed some of the whats. Uh-huh. We're okay. If you thought an open 17 footer was good and you ran an offense and your guy and Jerome Kersey ends up with an open baseline 17 footer, it's like, yes, we ran our offense well. And for the if your offense is trying to, you know, get Jerome Kersey an open 17 footer from the baseline, which, you know, kind of early 90s Portland did that a fair amount, just to pick an example, then, you know, you did well. Knowing now, you probably that would, you know, that's not necessarily, unless you're, you know, Flip Saunders or Randy Whitman, that's not the offense you're running anymore. So so it's changed the what we're trying to do. The how well, again, it's that's a strategic thing. That's we're kind of outside the realm of numbers once you know you answer the question. All right, how do we? Okay, we know we want to shoot as many open corner threes as possible. Okay, now let's figure out in basketball terms how we make that happen.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
No, and I think that the point that we kind of made before we started was, I think the revolution might be overblown insofar as I think that analytic optimists, of which we both occasionally are, tend to I don't understand, maybe not the sophistication is not the right word, but underestimate kind of how the baseline of how well, you know, play, you know, teams and coaches at a high level have been doing things. And, you know, the value of additional analytics is very different going from a starting point of 20 on a scale of 1 to 100 than from a starting point of 90. And I'm not going to say that we're starting from one spot or the other, but teams weren't doing that badly before, you know?
Yeah. And it's all self-contained. So it's, I don't know how I want to say it, but it's sort of like a reactive cycle. It's not like analytics has turned tennis into basketball or something like that. It's still basketball. Right. It was basketball before, and teams scored points and won games and won championships, and they still do that. It's adjusting. We see changes in the aesthetics somewhat.
Yeah, and there's obviously you know, competitive advantages to figuring something out a little bit before everybody else. But, you know, the team that's most kind of famous for doing that is a team that's not necessarily super analytic heavy, and that's the Spurs. And you want to talk about a guy who, you know, intuitively gets a lot of this stuff, that's Popovich, right? I mean, he doesn't like the three, but he understands why three is more than two.
Yeah,
you know, so
well, my head is spinning,
sorry.
That's all right. No. We definitely went down a rabbit hole here, but it's something I'd like to think about more. I mean, so often when we're dealing with these numbers, we're even when we're shading them, even when we're acknowledging that they don't represent the entirety of what's happening on the basketball court, the numbers still sort of feel somewhat absolute. But that there is, that those numbers change constantly, moment to moment on the court. And, you know, what we put in a graph on a Wednesday morning at Nylon Calculus, that, you know, that's subject to change as soon as the ball goes up.
Yeah, and, you know, think about how long it takes you to put together one of those graphs, and then how long and how long you have to make that decision on the floor. And it's you kind of, A, realize that, you know, the information might need to be a little presented a little differently to be actionable, mm-hmm. and also it's also understandable a little bit more why, well, that was a dumb play. It's like, well, no, that was a fast play, and mm-hmm. it happens. So
yeah.
Well, I mean, we sometimes do, but I mean, you don't necessarily you don't kill a guy because, all right, he got a good shot and he just missed a shot. Well, shucks.
Yeah.
I mean, keep shooting. I mean, you know, it's. That, you know, how is that much different than a guy making what's usually a good decision that due to some small circumstance wasn't in a particular case? So in the event, now you've got me preaching
all right, well, maybe that's a good place to leave it then.
Yeah.
Yeah. great conversation. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, we'll I think I've got this recording scheduled down. We're going to be going every week, so hopefully we'll have you back on again soon, and we'll build up some more to talk about, and we'll pick up where we left off.
All right, thanks a lot, Ian.
All right, thanks, Seth.